This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. I'll bet that you have a Gmail account, right? And you turn to Google Maps when you need to find your way to someplace new. Maybe you have an Android phone. Well, how did these products become such an indispensable part of our lives? How did two Stanford PhD dropouts build a company that touches everything we do online? My next guest, tech writer Stephen Levy, has been covering Google for over a decade, from way back in the early days when they were operating out of an office above a bicycle shop just off the Stanford campus. And in his new book, In the Plex, How Google Thinks, Works, and Shapes Our Lives, he gives us a sort of biography of the company and its founders, Larry Page and Sergey Brin. And inside, he gives us a look at how Google grew so quickly from small startup to internet giant with tens of thousands of employees, gobbling up companies like YouTube and Motorola for billions along the way. But can Google hold on to its empire? Or could Facebook be coming up next? Are the recommendations of your friends more important to you than the suggestions an algorithm spits out? Maybe you're already using Google's experiment in social media, Google Plus. We want to know what you think about Google. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. Stephen Levy is author of In the Plex, How Google Thinks, Works, and Shapes Our Lives. He's also senior writer at Wired here in New York, and he's in our New York studios. Good to have you back.
It's great to be back.
In the Plex, having the title has something to do with Google Plex in the old...
Yeah. The name of their campus is the Googleplex, and it's all a pun. It's a company that likes to have their fun. And the name Google comes from a mathematical term, which is a one followed by 100 zeros, a big number. And they deal in big data. That represents it. And I also misspelled it in part because it's fun to have those double O's that the original word doesn't have, and in part because they didn't get the domain name with the original spelling.
They didn't. Take us back to the late 90s. How did all of this get started?
So we have the internet. People thought that they searched it pretty good with the tools they had. There was a search engine called AltaVista, which everyone was impressed with. But Larry Page, a Stanford graduate student, as you mentioned, thought there might be a better way to do it. He came from an academic family. And he knew that one way to measure the popularity of academic articles was how many footnotes they had. And the World Wide Web had this tool that gave you a better way to search, which was these links. But in order to do that really well, you'd have to capture the entire World Wide Web on your computers. And he convinced his professors at Stanford to let him do that. And his buddy, Sergey Brin, another graduate student, did some of the mathematics that helped them interpret that. And lo and behold, they found by seeing what people linked to on the web, they could get better search results. And that's what they did. They tried to sell it to the other search companies, but those search companies were attached to these things called portals, which saw themselves as destination sites that people would come to. And they turned them away. They said, we don't want to buy this technology because it's too good. People would search for things and they'd leave our website and they wouldn't look at our headlines or our finance product or whatever. So get out of here. We don't want search that's that good. And what could they do but start a company?
So they started their own company. Did they think that this was a money-making project? That's what they were going to do.
Well, they felt that there was money to be made. They weren't 100% certain how it would be made. They thought, well, ads might be one way, but they had a problem with that because they hated advertising and wanted to figure out a new way to do advertising that wasn't intrusive, that users wouldn't blanch when they saw it. And they thought maybe we'll license it to some other companies and maybe we'll sell the technology to corporations that want to search within their own private internets, their intranets. And it was a problem for a while. The people who funded them, they got a lot of venture capital money at the end of the boom. And then harder times came to Silicon Valley and the venture capitalists began getting a little nervous saying, where's the money, guys? They were getting a lot of users. And then they invented a new ad product, which turned out to be exactly what satisfied their standard for what advertising should be. They felt the advertising should be as useful to the user as the search results. And they came up with an amazing formula that let them do that. And it turned out to be the most successful advertising product in the history of the internet, probably the most successful product in this century so far.
No kidding. And they keep secret these advertising formulas and their Google search formulas, things like that.
They keep a lot of secrets, but they've been a little more open. They don't like it when you call them black boxes. And I sat down with them. I spent a lot of time with all the search engineers and the ad engineers so I could explain to people how this stuff works. And as it turns out, if you learn how search works, if you learn how Google Ad works, you learn a lot about how Google thinks.
And how does a search work? Give us an idea what goes into a search.
So we talked a little bit about the basic ingredient of Google search originally, why it was so good, because
right.
It used these links. So if you figure it, if on my website, I like the Philadelphia Phillies, and if I put the Philadelphia Phillies in something that I'm writing on my blog or something like that, and it's underlined like a link, that's called anchor text, the place that I'm going to link it to probably is the homepage of the Philadelphia Phillies. And if other people do that, and if important sites, much more important than my blog, like the New York Times does that, that's an amazing way to tell that this is the most important location for that term. And they could figure this out because they analyzed all these links on the web there. So that was the first thing. It was sort of a crowdsourced way to know what's important. And the name of that technology was called PageRank, not on web pages, but Larry Page, the Stanford student.
That right?
That's right. But as Google evolved, that PageRank was still an important component, but less crucial. It actually became sort of an artificial intelligence learning machine because Google got a lot of data from the way people searched, and they watched the way people behaved on the search engine, and they learned which searches were more effective, which locations satisfied which kinds of searches. It even learned about the language. If someone searched for a dog and didn't like what they found, they might then type in puppy. And the search engine, enough people did that, figured dog, puppy, that's kind of alike.
So it's sort of an artificial intelligence that's going on there.
Yeah, it's sort of like one of the science fiction things where you sort of like grow an intelligence in a big jar or something like that. Their search engine got to know things. And it learned more and more things. And, you know, it could even learn how to translate one language from another just by watching the way people operated and making use of the massive amounts of data available to Google. So as things go on, it really is something that learns by people search. And the more people search, the better it learned. And it was a real virtuous cycle.
You have spanned many of the greatest minds in Silicon Valley, Steve Jobs and now Larry Page and Sergey. And in your book, you talk about how Steve Jobs tried to mentor both Page and Brin, but their relationship changed when Google came out with an Android phone.
That's right.
What happened there?
Yeah, for a while, it looked like Steve Jobs and Sergey is like Humphrey Bogart and Claude Rains, a beautiful friendship. And Steve was impressed by them, and he was especially impressed because this was a partnership he could have, mainly to square off against Microsoft and other competitors, where they were entirely complementary. He figured he wasn't going to build the search engine, and they weren't going to build a phone. And then Google said, well, we bought this company called Android, but it really isn't going to be the kind of stuff that you do. But then Steve came out with the iPhone, and Google realized that we better shelve the rather rudimentary phone that we're working on first and go to our future phone. And that looked a lot like the iPhone, behaved a lot like the iPhone. And when Steve got wind of that, he felt personally betrayed, and he got very angry.
Is a falling out between them?
It definitely was.
Mm-hmm. Would you consider he to be the new Steve Jobs? Would Google be the new Apple on the block here?
Yeah, there are some aspects that are similar. Larry Page, who's the CEO now of Google, he was the original CEO. And then after much pressure from the venture capitalists who wanted, quote, adult supervision, they brought in someone. First, they wanted Steve Jobs. They thought that was the only guy that they would accept as a CEO, and that wasn't going to happen.
No.
But they settled on Eric Schmidt, who they liked because he was an engineer. He'd been to Burning Man, which was an event that both Larry and Sergey had attended, and it showed something about him. And for 10 years, Eric did an excellent job of building it from a small company to a bigger company, but now Larry came back. And I think there's some aspects, just in terms of being driven and determined and ambitious and product-oriented, that are similar to Steve. He does not have Steve Jobs' personal charisma. You won't see him, you know, doing keynotes and saying, there's one more thing, and then here's the next Google project.
So he's not going to fill a void as Steve leaves the stage now in public life.
I think that Steve is unique, and I think that in his own way, you know, people like Larry, and you know, you look at other people coming up, Jack Dorsey, who's you know important person at Twitter and Square, the payment thing that you know the people saying there's a lot of extraordinary people out there, but only one Steve Jobs.
1-800-999-8255. Talking with Stephen Levy, author of In the Plex: How Google Thinks, Works, and Shapes Our Lives. If I remember correctly, you also were an author of Insanely Great.
That is true. Yes, that's.
How do you get access to Steve Jobs, to all these great pioneers, and did they just let you in the door?
Well, I've been doing this for a while, so I kind of got in before the some of those guys were famous, and then I talked to the Bill Gates and Steve Jobs, and then these other people figured, God, I guess he knows Bill Gates and Steve Jobs. We have to talk to him too.
Were they easy to talk to, these guys from Google, or are they different, in a different world than you were?
I think they were easier to spend time with in the earlier days. When I signed up to do the book, they let me get a great access to the company. And Larry and Sergey and Eric all had to sign off on it because I got amazing access. I got to talk to virtually any person in the company. I got access to products while they were being developed. I got to sit in on some amazing meetings like the search launch meeting where they talk about what changes they're going to make to the search engine. Even though I'd run into Larry and Sergey quite often, I really had to push to get these long sit-down interviews that were so useful to me.
Now we'll talk more with Stephen Levy, author of In the Plex. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. Talk about Google. We'll also talk about does Facebook represent a challenge that they should worry about? What about all these other things Google's getting into with voice and the Google Groups now, Google Plus? I mean, are you a Google Plus member? Do you like it? Does it work as well for you? Are you willing to trade off your friends in Facebook? Are they more worthwhile than a good search engine? Some questions and answers coming up after this break. Stay with us. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about Google, a company many of us probably couldn't go a day without, at least for searching. Have you tried not using Gmail or Google Search for a day or two? Where's the company going, though? What's it up to? We're here to talk about it, and fill us in is Stephen Levy. He's author of In the Plex, How Google Thinks, Works, and Shapes Our Lives. He's also a senior writer at Wired here in New York. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Google seems to be just growing horizontally. Is that a good thing? I mean, are they going to take on Facebook and become a social community like they're trying with Google Plus?
Well, they figured out after several products that really didn't work so well in the social world, that they couldn't fool around. They absolutely had to have a big, successful social product because Facebook was getting all this amazing information about people that people voluntarily gave to Facebook, who their friends are, what they're interested in, what their activities are. And Google's mission is to access all the world's information and organize it. And this was really important information. If Google knew what you liked, they can give you better search results. They could do all sorts of things, show you better ads. And, you know, and so they figured we have to do this because if Facebook builds this information sphere that we can't get hold of, maybe they could do a search engine next. Who knows what they could do? So they put together a huge effort, one of the biggest ones in their history. There was codenamed Emerald Sea. Originally, they thought they'd get it out in 100 days, but it was more ambitious. It took longer. And eventually, they did put it out a couple months ago in what they call a field test. But what we're seeing now, you know, it has a couple pretty innovative things, like one thing called Circles that enables you to determine what you share and who you share it with a little more easily than you can with Facebook. But more is going to come online. Eventually, all of Google will be more social, and that's part of this wider experiment they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Of course, Microsoft bought Skype so that we can have voice things going on. Google has its own.
Right. Yeah, Google had an opportunity to buy Skype. I tell a story in the book how the guy in charge of the Google product, which is sort of a competitor to Skype, Google Voice, didn't like the idea that Google was going to buy Skype. So he actually planted a trap in a big meeting. He got Sergey on his side and another powerful person at Google, a guy named Salar, who's now the CEO of YouTube. And they basically went into the meeting pretending they liked the idea. But halfway through the meeting, they started asking all these questions. What about this? What about that? Isn't the government going to hold this up for a year before we do this? Who's going to go out to Europe to supervise these people? And by the end of it, the deal was off. So Google did not buy Skype. And there's other company bought it from eBay and then sold it to Microsoft there.
So you think there's going to be a battle in that arena too? Google's girding for battle there in the voice?
Oh, definitely.
Telephony sort of thing?
Definitely.
Video?
Well, now they have they're buying Motorola. My suspicion is that eventually they're going to buy a network.
TV network?
No, a broadband network.
Oh, the whole like Comcast or something?
Yeah. So if you remember, a few years ago, they were bidding on broadband spectrum, but they were only doing it in order to lure other companies in, because the way this particular auction worked, the rules were that if you bought the spectrum, you had to make it more open. You couldn't just control it. You had to let other people use their equipment on the spectrum, and he couldn't control it. And Google liked that idea. But if no one bid on this auction, if no one met the reserve, then those rules would go away. So Google had to bid high enough for the auction to be official, but then was hoping that someone would bid higher. And after a few tense days, someone did top Google. It was Verizon top Google. But at that point, Larry Page, who's a very ambitious guy, started asking, well, why don't we keep going? Why don't we buy the spectrum? And Google wasn't ready to be a phone company. Everyone said, no, Larry, we can't do that. And they backed down. But I think next time around, they might keep bidding.
Do you think this is in their 5-10-year plan?
Maybe. One interesting possibility would be now that AT&T looks like it might not buy T-Mobile, Google might be interested.
1-800-989-8255, which leads us to Cameron in Boonesboro, Maryland's question. Hi, Cameron.
Hi, Ira. I love Google. I use it every day, but honestly, I'm scared of it. Every click, every search I make is probably cataloged somewhere and in my file, at least with my ISP. And the other people I work with feel the same way. I mean, as Google grows, will what I search be someday in a court case against me? Will someday
can the government subpoena his Google messages and things?
So this is interesting. I mentioned before how important user behavior was for Google to keep improving the search engine. So they keep that information. And the caller's right, not Cameron's right, not by his name, but by his ISP. They give him a number and say that this number behaves in this way. That information is very important to them. They keep it for 18 months, and they think that's the minimum they need in order to be really useful there. But they have all sorts of other information about you, which is somewhat siloed. But if you sign in to Google and use that information is accessible to you, and Google also keeps it. And now people are suspicious of Google. When it was a young, feisty startup, people didn't have these fears. But in the years that I was writing, covering it for the book and really immersed in it, it was fascinating to see how the image of Google switched from a David to a Goliath. And now people are worried about this information. And I think they should be concerned.
You think they should?
I think any company, even a well-intentioned company, because as the caller said, what if Google keeps the information safe, but they get a subpoena for it by keeping your information, letting one company have so much information about you, a legal subpoena can get that information, whereas otherwise it might not be available.
Of course, Google is famous for its motto, "Don't be evil."
That is true. And what I found was fascinating was that a lot of the executives did not shy away from that, even though a lot of people use it as a bludgeon. Every time Google makes a mistake, they all say, oh, what happened to don't be evil, Mr. Google? How about that? But they still think that it was useful as a way internally to say, you know, if this is this, they would talk about an initiative. And they'd say, well, is that evil? And it's like the, you know, the Supreme Court about obscenity. You know it when you see it. And sometimes people would say, no, I guess we shouldn't do that. It's evil. As you get to be a bigger company, things get a little fuzzier.
Let's go to Bill in Illinois. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Mm-hmm.
I had a question as to whether or not Google helps to reinforce people's political viewpoints. That is, if somebody is a conservative and they consistently visit conservative websites, and then they've developed this history of visiting conservative websites, and then they type in a search term like global warming, will they be more likely to be guided to websites that take a conservative perspective on global warming? And thank you.
So this is what's known as the filter bubble problem. Yeah, and there's a pretty good book about that recently. Google says, and I imagine they probably have data to prove it, the degree to which personalization gives you search results is not so much that you would be blocked from sites that disagree with you there. And you can turn it off. You could, you know, log into Google without any kind of sign in, you could get a clean search without personalization there. And I think you can argue the opposite too. You could say, because Google gives you such a wide range of things, if you are open and you want to learn about different things, it's easier to find things that are opposed to your point of view. If our tendency is to want to read things that we agree with, Google will indulge you on that. But the opposite is true, too.
1-800-999-8255. Google now is involved in an antitrust investigation with the Federal Trade Commission. Correct.
Yes.
What's the problem? And they're going to be testifying in Capitol Hill.
Yes. Yes. They've asked for either Eric Schmidt or Larry Page, and Eric is going to go and defend Google's practices before a Senate committee. There, it's not directly related to the FTC probe, and the European Union is also investigating them. The problem, there's two problems. There's search and ads. The search problem is that some people complain that Google might give favorable positioning to its own products. And they also say that it's got too much power, that if Google doesn't like you or determines your site is misbehaving, it could give you the death penalty. It could drop you in the standings. And for a lot of companies, where you are on those rankings is life and death. If people can't see you high in a search, they can't do business. In ads, people complain the formula Google uses isn't a straightforward formula. It's an auction, but the winner of the auction isn't necessarily the advertiser that bids the highest. There's a formula involved that based on, in part, how good Google thinks the ad is. And you know, the people who are the losers in this formula say similarly that we can't get access to this. So the complainants really are companies that don't do well in Google search or Google ads, and they want oversight. Well, Google's answer is that this is an editorial opinion where we rank things. And actually, a judge actually has ruled earlier this century, I think in 2003 or 2004, that it is protected opinion where you rank things, like a movie review. Google has to use some opinion, it's the algorithm's opinion, and they make the algorithms on where these things go. They can't give you the web in alphabetical order. So they're saying, if you don't like it, go somewhere else who gives you better search results.
Let's go to Bruce in Danville, California. Hi, Bruce. Bruce.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Yahoo invented the original search when they were at Stanford, and then Google took that on. Apple invented the iPhone, which is an object that can also buy cool apps and then use it on the phone, which is pretty much what Android does. And then now with Google Docs, which I love, I'm not sure I should say this, but I love it. They're basically taking on Microsoft's Office suite, which is word processing, Excel spreadsheets, and PowerPoint presentations. And now with Skype and also with Facebook and their own Google Plus, it seems like they're just taking other people's ideas and then just repositioning them in under the Google sort of umbrella. How do they get away with that? I don't think I can launch a Facebook competing app myself and then think I can just exist. So how does Google get away with this?
Well, I think you're right in terms of social. They're pursuing Facebook, and a lot of people in Google have mixed feelings about this. One person told me when they were developing this, they said, this isn't really like Google. Google doesn't chase taillights. Drunks chase taillights. We go ahead. And I would take issue on some of the things you said. Yahoo's search was not an algorithmic search. They curated the web. It was smaller and easier to find interesting things and organize it in that fashion. So the algorithmic way that Google took on the web was innovative and creative. And something like Gmail, it wasn't the first web-based mail, but they were creative in terms of first to recognize that they can give you more storage and make search an important part of mail. So I think through its history, Google has added innovations to existing products. Microsoft had to follow Google in making its making its applications web-based. So Microsoft didn't invent applications either.
Mm-hmm. All right, Bruce, thanks for calling.
Thank you.
This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow talking with Steve Levy, author of In the Plex, How Google Thinks, Works, and Shapes Our Lives. Do you think you know how Google thinks?
I have a pretty good idea. I spent enough time
drunk
there.
Drunk from the Kool-Aid?
I'm not smart enough to get hired by Google, but it sunk in after a while.
Yeah, and can you predict where are they going? Because you know how they think.
I can predict sort of the way they'll go there. Exactly where they're going, maybe only Larry knows.
Uh-huh. You don't think Larry, as you say, is going to replace Steve Jobs as the great Silicon Valley thinker?
Well, there's only one Steve Jobs, but I think you'd say there's only one Larry Page too.
Right.
He has some personality traits and some quirks which are uniquely Larry.
If you want to be hired by Google, you're thinking the way that you do, is it better not to go to college? Is it better to drop out and have your own ideas and start your own startup company, and then they find you?
No. They actually value an elite education. That's something that they're important. When they recruit, they care a lot about what school you go to. And actually, some people in their human relations department, it's called people operations, very googly, They say, well, we're missing out on people, but Larry and Sergey had elite educations, and they see the world that way. They ask you your SAT score and your college GPAs, even if you're 40 years old. They ask you that. They say, I don't remember what I got in college. Look it up. And Larry Page signs off on every single employee that Google hires to this day.
He does his own interview, or he just signs them?
He signs off. They give him a little package with just the top information. And the way this works is that he can kind of then use his mouse and drill down if he sees something he doesn't like. And sometimes he'll say, well, what about this? And bounce something.
And does every employee have open door to Larry Page?
No.
No. Did it used to be there?
It used to be more open. Now, where Larry is, there is actually in the elevator, it says only Googlers with permission can go there.
It says that in the elevator?
Yeah.
And how do you know if you have permission? You get a card?
You find out if you don't have permission.
But they did try to do away with the managers you talk about in your book at one point.
Well, Larry's obsessed with making Google work like a smaller company. He doesn't like the concept of middle management. And when the company got to 400 people, he thought, this is too big. We got to do something about it. And he tried to get rid of all the middle managers. They had 100 engineers reporting to one guy. And that didn't work. And so they drew back from that. But I think that they try to do things which make it feel smaller. They try to keep groups small, and they try to keep the way that decisions are made on a consensus-based means where people can't pull rank because of their seniority, and the decisions are made ideally by data. You can't get rid of politics, but Google tries as much as possible to hire smart people who understand that data should be the basis of the decision, not politics.
Last question. Now with Motorola, is that phone going to have Larry Page's signature on it? Just like Steve Jobs used to check off on everything that came out, that hardware that came out?
He'll watch certain products pretty closely, and he'll watch this, and I'm sure they'll have to do product reviews before we we see it released to the public.
How soon do you think we'll see a new Google phone come out?
They try to work pretty quickly. Maybe next year. Well, first, actually, it's going to take them a few months at minimum to get that that acquisition approved.
Right.
But after that, I think they might move pretty fast.
All right. You should know. Stephen Levy is author of the book In the Plex, How Google Thinks, Works, and Shapes Our Lives. Also senior writer at DeWired here in New York. Always a pleasure to have you.
Same here. I really enjoyed it.
We'll have you back later. We're going to take a short break, and we're going to switch gears. When we come back, we're going to talk about, well, how can I say it? Panda poop. There you go. And why it's so interesting and important to the future maybe of alternative fuels. Yeah, I'll get you thinking about it. We'll be talking about it when we get back after the break, so stay with us.